The hour of 12:30, having arrived, I'll call to order Higher Education Finance and Policy. Members, I'm hoping you're remembering to bring this because we have one for everyone and we don't even have an extra one for our staff yet, which is a reminder to Minskew that they could produce a few more. So if Minskew would come up and continue with either where they left off or they had some questions that members had raised from the previous hearing. Representative Brainerd, that was you.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Chancellor Rosenstone, when we left off last week, you had responded to a question from Representative Norton regarding business and industry partnerships, and you talked quite a bit about the Itasca project and some of the goals and successes there. And that's all very exciting, but one part you didn't get to that I'm very interested in and is what financial commitment or interest there might be there from the private sector in terms of supporting that work. And I'll give you just a bit of context for my question. There was a time in higher education when graduates were hired and they were trained by business and industry, and that cost was seen as a part of private sector investment. And I think we're shifting quite a bit that cost to the public sector in terms of more identified job training programs, and I'm not saying for good or ill, we've had quite a change in what the global marketplace looks like and so forth, but because of that shift, I'm wanting to know about the private sector's commitment to the type of training we're currently engaged in.
Chancellor Rosenstone, welcome to committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. I'm Stephen Rosenstone, Chancellor of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I'm joined again by Vice Chancellor King, our Chief Financial Officer, and also today by Craig Schoeniger, the System Director for Research and Planning. Chair Pawlowski, Representative Brainerd, wonderful question, and answer comes in a couple parts. First, as we discussed last time, the customized training that we provide, which is training for incumbent workers, is almost exclusively paid for by the firms themselves. Secondly, as we will discuss in more detail when we get to our priorities for the current biennium we're about to enter in, we are proposing that business and industry play a much larger role in supporting our students and their training programs. We will be suggesting that there be a dollar-for-dollar match on the paid internship program we want to create. There be a dollar-for-dollar match on the equipment we need to have to ensure we have state-of-the-art equipment to train our students to be prepared for work, and we'll be embarking on a $20 million scholarship campaign to help on the affordability front, and I'm quite sure there'll be opportunities for business energy to help on that front as well.
Representative Brainerd, all right,
thank you.
That's good. All right, any other questions? Then Chancellor, proceed.
Thank you, Chair Pawlowski. It is a great pleasure to be back with everyone today. As I briefly discussed with you prior to the meeting, we're prepared to take on two big topics. I don't know whether we'll get through both these topics today because each of them are pretty big, but we'll go at the pace that makes sense for the committee. First is changes in enrollment, faculty and staff, administrative costs, and the system office. And the second topic, which I know is also important to the committee, changes in tuition and fees and graduate debt. Something with today's headlines, of course, is back in the press yet again. And so with your permission, we simply begin. We'll move at the pace that makes sense for the committee, but we are prepared to take on these two topics today if there's time to do so. If not, we'll continue next time.
All right, so where do you want to pick up?
Well, we have a couple slides that will help walk folks through it. I think we're at tab maybe three, four. We'll grab our book and we'll let you know.
I was in tab four.
Tab five.
Tab. All right. Tab five.
As we saw last time we were together, over the entire period of the last decade, enrollment grew by 18%. But over the years that you've asked us to focus on, 2006 through 2012, enrollment has grown. 13%, roughly 57,500 students. During the same time period, there has been an increase in 656 employees, or roughly an increase of 3.8%. So put differently, enrollment grew by 15%, number of employees grew by less than 4%. For every 88 additional students, we've had to add an employee to serve those students. Those additional employees are largely faculty and academic professionals, and I'll give you the details breakdown in just a moment. Being able to grow our student population much faster than our employee base, of course, is a sign of efficiency, and we'll get into some of those details in just a moment as well. The next slide breaks down by employee group exactly what the changes have been over these years. So, for example, between 2006 and 2012, we added 215 faculty. We reduced
campus. Chancellor, slow down just one
please.
Second. I think you've jumped ahead of our ability to find out where you are.
Okay.
So
this
why don't you give us a page number?
This and chart is not in your book. We'll make copies and make sure they're available to you.
Okay, that would explain why we can't find it.
The data are, but we did roll up from the many, many charts that are there something that would try to summarize it in a little more useful fashion. So the raw data are there in the book. This is an attempt to roll it up in a fashion that would be a little more easy to understand.
It would be helpful if you're going to do this in the future that you bring this particular chart so we've got it in front of us when you're going to use it that way. Otherwise, these screens really are not that easy to see, even when we're on top of them like this.
Be happy to.
All right.
Be happy to. So over this period, academic professionals, which are the academic and financial aid advisors, the student support coordinators, registered, information technology specialists and the like, they grew by 490 people, managers and supervisors 53, and over this time period of roughly 57,500 new students being added, there were across the entire system, colleges, universities and the like, a grand total of 30 additional administrators during the period.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Chancellor Rosenstone, it's hard for us to, you know, the numbers are interesting, but I'm curious about percentages, and so I don't know if we're going to leave this up long enough that I can calculate them on my own, or if you maybe your previous slide expresses the same thing as an aggregate, and you can break it down, or maybe that's another one of the slides we don't have that we're going to see.
If you take out your pencil, I can recite the percentages, and as we provide copies of the slides, the committee will make sure the percentages are penciled in. Instructional faculty grew by 2.1% over this period. Service and support declined by 3.4%. The academic professionals grew by 21%. Managers and supervisors, 12%.
Chancellor, explain what campus service and support is.
I'd be happy to. It includes clerical staff, receptionists, accountants, librarians, technicians, groundkeepers, security guards. These are largely AFSCME employees.
Chancellor, during this time period, did you add on new buildings to the Minsky system?
Mr. Chair, Laura King, Vice Chancellor. We have had some additional square footage. I can't tell you offhand, but I can find out for you.
Well, offhand, I can tell you in one area of the state where some new buildings have been added. So my question would be, as you add on new buildings and you actually decline in the support service, when you're adding new buildings onto a campus, are you taking so many buildings offline that you can shift those people to the new buildings? Vice Chancellor?
Mr. Chair, we have had some demolition, but it's not the case that we fund additional support to pay for additional square footage.
Well, I can think of one southeastern campus where one small building was demolished, but several extraordinarily large buildings were added during this time period.
That's right.
And it would appear that you just stretched the support services in order to accommodate it, but you managed to hire other people in other areas during the time period.
Mr. Chair, I'll look into the square footage change from 2006. I don't have it by campus here in front of me.
Well, Vice Chancellor King, or Chancellor Rosenstone, I believe that you are proposing in this legislative session the number of new buildings. And are we going to see a further decline in support services as these new buildings come online? You don't need to answer the question now, but it is a disturbing trend when you're adding on new buildings and you're actually declining in the support for the new buildings, but you seem to be able to add on people everywhere else.
Chair Pawlowski, members of the committee.
Chancellor Rosenstone.
These are largely decisions made by the colleges and universities. They're not decisions made in the central office. Secondly, all of our colleges and universities during this entire time period are looking for more efficient ways to manage almost everything they are doing. If we have the same space but can manage it more efficiently by sharing resources across several campuses that are nearby, That's a good thing, not a bad thing. And so in some cases, they're sharing protective services, they're sharing janitorial staff, they're sharing snow plowing and the like. I don't think we should be discouraging that kind of activity. If the condition of our facilities or the ability of those facilities to serve our students has deteriorated over this time period, then I think we have a source of concern.
Well, Chancellor, I'd like to see the same theory applied to, for instance, administrators. Maybe you could stretch your administrators a little bit more, too, over the same time period. Their salaries would be excessive compared to someone who's employed by ASME. So could we see the same type of stringent application of that principle when we get to administrators, too? Because you apparently had to increase the administrators during the time period.
Chair Pawlowski, we'll get into some of those details in just a few moments. These increases are on campuses. They're not in the system office.
Well,
so these are decisions being made by our campus leaders.
I understand that, but the system office is before us, and I know this system well enough to know that decisions that are made on campus somehow filter up to Minsky Central. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor Rosenstone, I'm looking at yours. It's marked 5-1, table 5-1. I wonder if you could just explain, maybe it's the difference in general fund FTEs, but on your system total faculty 2012, you show 82.89.5 instructional faculty, and this chart shows a total of 10,347. The one that you have on the screen, I'm sorry. So I don't know, just if you could explain the discrepancy.
Chair Pawlowski.
Chancellor Rosenstone.
Representative Winkler, the chart that you're looking at now, going back to an earlier conversation, is headcount. The one in the book is FTE, which is full-time equivalents. So if you have two part-time faculty, each working 50%, on the full-time equivalent, it counts as one person. On this chart that you're looking at, it's headcount.
So,
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Chancellor Rosenstone, the chart you have on the screen shows total number of individuals working in faculty positions, even if they're not working full-time.
Correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Chancellor Rosenstone, do you have any, I imagine that you have a full breakdown of that those faculty numbers, but I'd just, you know, as we're looking at the trends over time and a 2.1% faculty increase, I guess if it's just based on individuals and not FTEs, it's harder to determine what that really means.
Chancellor Rosenstone. Representative Winkler, if you'd like us to redo the chart for you in FYEs, I believe we could do that.
Chancellor, just another question on the chart you have up there. Is the increase in the number of administrators, that's a decision that's made at the campus level also?
Chair Pawlowski, if the administrator is employed at the campus level, it is a decision made at the campus level.
All right. We'll revisit that, too, I think, as we continue here. But that is a disturbing trend considering the other trend that's up there. But all right. Proceed.
To break out.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Chancellor Rosenstone, I don't remember if you gave us the percentage on administrators from that previous slide. Last I saw was 12% increase in managers and supervisors.
5.6%.
5.6%.
Thank you, Chancellor. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Chancellor, one follow-up question then. You described in general the differences between campus supervisors and support and academic professionals, but it wasn't clear to me from a conceptual basis what the difference is.
Chancellor Rosenstone.
May I ask Craig Schoenecker,
sure,
your expert on this, to respond?
Is it Schoenecker?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Schoenecker.
For the record, my name is Craig Schoenecker, System Director for Research with the Minsky System. The campus service and support grouping is the employees that are represented by AFSCME would be the typically support staff, clerical staff, grounds workers on campus, technicians, accounting technicians. The professional group would be individuals that would be, examples would be accountants. An accountant would be a professional. An accounting technician would be a support, service and support employee. Professionals also would include our academic advisors, the employees who coordinate student support services, coordinate tutoring labs, that type of thing. There are also, there would be analysts, management analysts in the professional group. So those are some additional examples of the of those two groups.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I didn't hear the testifier's last name.
Shaniker, Greg Shaniker.
Mr. Shaniker, from a simple person's point of view, I guess, it seems to me that academic professionals would include a lot of people that other people would call administrators. They're not teaching and they're not providing direct service to students. What is the definition then of administrators and managers and supervisors? How do these all differ from each other?
Chair Pulaski,
Mr. Shaniker,
Representative Winkler. Administrators are the top leadership positions, both at the campuses and the system office, presidents, vice presidents, associate vice presidents, and deans. The professional staff, by and large, would not be supervising employees. There are a few of the professionals that do supervise employees at the state universities, but by and large, they are going to be working either directly with students or providing other kinds of, fulfilling other kinds of professional responsibilities and not be in a position where they're making substantive decisions about the operation of the college or university. Another contrast between the two groups is the professionals are all included in state-defined bargaining units and are represented by either the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees or the Minnesota State University service employees, whereas administrators within the system are covered by a pay plan that is approved by the Board of Trustees. Administrators are also at-will employees within the system, whereas the professional groups are covered by collective bargaining agreements with layoff provisions.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, so just the difference then between academic professionals and managers and supervisors is that the managers and supervisors group essentially are the people who are the supervisors of the academic professionals, but they're not rising to the level of presidents, vice presidents, and deans.
Shaniker.
Chair Pulaski, Representative Winkler, that is correct. Supervisors would be supervising professionals, the service and support staff as well, and then administrators would be the top leadership.
Thank you.
Mr. Winkler. Mr. Shaniker, I apologize for you not being on the list. We did ask Mr. Janicich in advance for the people who are testifying. I do prefer to have the names in advance so we can list them on the agenda and so that all the members would have the names in front of them. So I would hope that in the future, when we request who's coming, that Mr. Janicich or whoever at Minsky Central could get us the names so we can put them on the agenda.
So Chair Pulaski,
it's our mistake for not having your name, but we did make a request.
We'll comply with that request.
Okay. Chancellor?
Chair Pulaski, the next slide simply takes the data from the previous table and puts it in a perhaps more easily digestible form. Gives you a sense of the distribution headcount of all employees across the entire system in 2012. Managers and supervisors comprise 2.7% of the employees, administrators 3.1%. To kind of understand the overall budget of our colleges, universities, and system, roughly two-thirds of all the expenses are for salary and compensation of all the employees that are in this pie chart. As we think about the cost of higher education,
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Chancellor Rosenstone, in the previous pie chart, I think you've stated that is by headcount.
Chancellor Rosenstone.
Chair Pulaski, Representative Winkler, yes.
And Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Chancellor, I think it would also be interesting to see that based on an FTE count as well, based on the fact that maybe you can just tell us roughly of that faculty headcount, how many of those positions are full-time versus part-time.
Mr. Shaniker?
Chair Pulaski, Representative Winkler, we don't have that detail with us, but the full-time equivalent of faculty would be a somewhat smaller number than the headcount because we do employ many part-time faculty teaching one course or two courses for a term or even once a year. But we can provide that detail for you.
Mr. Shinneker, when you provide that detail, can you provide it in a way where we can see if there's been an increase in this adjunct faculty over the last 6 years or a decrease in the adjunct faculty, and in what areas you may be hiring adjunct faculty as opposed to full-time? Adjunct faculty would be a significant savings for you, I understand that, but it also means a different level of education. Speaking as someone who is adjunct faculty, I know exactly how they're treated. So,
Chair Plowski, we certainly can provide that detail, sorting out the difference between the adjunct and the permanent faculty and full-time and part-time and what those trends have been.
And Mr. Shinneker, is that decision made at the campus level too?
Chair Plowski, yes, that is a campus decision.
All right. Rev. Sam Pop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you be able to maybe just now or in the future be able to say which bargaining unit or classification these areas are in? That might be helpful to understand kind of as far as you're describing their differences.
Mr. Shinneker.
Chair Plowski, Representative Poppy, yes. The faculty slice of this pie would be the faculty at the state universities that are represented by the interfaculty organization, as well as the faculty at the state colleges represented by Minnesota State College faculty. The managers would be primarily the Middle Management Association, employees represented by MMA. Administrators would be the administrators covered by the Board of Trustees pay plan for administrators. Academic professionals would be the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, primarily at our colleges. At the universities, it's the Minnesota State University Professional Employee Association. And then support, service and support employees would be those represented by AFSCME.
Representative Pott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As this is just laid out, would managers and supervisors only be able to supervise academic professionals and administrators only be in supervision for faculty?
Mr. Shinneker.
Chair Pulaski, Representative Poppy. Managers and supervisors would supervise academic professionals, service and support, and generally it would be administrators supervising the faculty, deans, or associate vice presidents at the colleges and universities.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chancellor, could you, when you're putting together the FTDs for this slide for Representative Winkler, also put a dollar amount on each category?
Mr. Shinneker, our Chancellor, our Vice Chancellor.
I think all three of us would be pleased to do so, if we can. All right, we'll see if we can do that.
Proceed.
Thank you. The next slide is the introduction to the topic of administrative costs and how those administrative costs have changed over time and how it feeds into the tuition access and affordability for our students. The first thing we need to do kind of as a background is remind ourselves that access and affordability are key to the system of MNSCU. These are key principles that are central to our serving the people of Minnesota. We are, by a long shot, the most affordable higher education alternative available in the state. Tuition and fees at our colleges are roughly one-third the cost of the for-profit options. An education at one of our universities is roughly 57% the cost at the University of Minnesota, and about one-fifth the cost at one of the private colleges in the state of Minnesota. Total expenses over time per student we are serving in constant dollars has declined. Declined about 12.5% between 2002 and 2012.
Chancellor, can you go back to that other slide for a second? When we're looking at these costs, are you factoring in financial aid, or is it net or gross, or what exactly are we looking at here?
Chair Pulaski, these are the sticker prices for all tuition and fees. So either the state grant, Pell grants, institutional support, private support, are factored into any of these calculations.
Okay, that helps. Thank you.
As I was saying on this slide, the actual expense of educating a student in MNSCU has declined over time in constant dollars. This is a sign of growing efficiency with which we're able to serve students. Obviously, and we'll get to this in just a few moments, who's paying those costs has shifted quite a bit as state support has been cut over time.
Representative Winkler.
But the actual cost of educating a student has not gone up. It's actually gone down in constant dollars.
Excuse me, Chancellor. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Chancellor, another way to, I mean, there, when you say total expense, I assume that means total budget per FYE?
Chair Pelosi, Representative Winkler.
Chancellor.
Yes.
And Mr. Chair, Chancellor, what I don't, you know, I don't know if we can really get to this. It's completely a subjective and qualitative observation, but just because you're spending less per student doesn't mean that you're actually getting them more value. It just might mean that services are being cut or classes are getting bigger or more adjunct faculty, you know, anybody they can get, Mr. Chair, are teaching students. And so, I mean, we don't really know what the qualitative impact of this chart is, and I wonder if you could speak to that. I mean, we have the previous numbers you gave us on faculty growth and other professional categories growth, but how do you really measure the quality of what they're getting?
Chancellor.
Chair Pelosi, Representative Winkler, that's a great question, and we could have an entire session just talking about the measures of quality. We focus not on the ACT scores of our freshmen, but on the performance and capabilities of our graduates. We set learning outcome measures for almost every single one of the programs within the system. Those measures are set in collaboration with business and industry so that we're assuring that the graduates we're turning out are indeed the graduates that are meeting the standards needed by employers. Over 80% of our students are getting jobs right out of college or university in a chosen or related field. And in many of our programs, employers are waiting there as students are enrolling in the program to try to recruit them, knowing the quality that they're going to get. We can have a session that would get into substantial more detail about how we assess learning outcomes and what our performance is with respect to job placement and the like. But I quite agree with you. This is not a chart that describes changes in quality. It's only the financial chart. But we do focus very intently on the quality of our graduates and whether they're indeed graduating with the skills necessary for the work that needs to be done.
And Mr.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, my only observation is that we are certainly spending less per enrolled student per FYE than we were in the past. And that's the conclusion I reach from this chart.
Chair Pelosi, we are not suggesting you reach any more of a conclusion than that, but if part of what our conversations are over these days is to try to understand the facts with respect to budget and the like, I think it's essential observation in that conversation to understand that in real dollars, the cost of serving students has not only not been going up in Minsky, it's actually been coming down.
And Chancellor, would that support the previous Chancellor's comments that you really, the cuts didn't hurt and they were acceptable and you dealt with them very well, so therefore you do not need more state funding?
Chair Pelosi, absolutely not. And that's precisely the conversation we had in our last session together. We talked about the program cuts. We talked about the decline in equipment necessary to serve students. We talked about the growing class size. We talked about places where there's a constraint on the courses that are available. We've talked about the layoffs. We've talked about all of that. So to argue that because we have adjusted to the declining state support, that's a better way for Minnesota proceeding, that is indeed not the conclusion one should reach from this chart.
And Chancellor Rosen, I want to remind you that you're talking about it because it's been requested of you to talk about it this session. And actually, we had numerous conversations in my office to make sure it was understood that we would talk about it this session.
Chair Pelosi, I am pleased to talk about this.
So am I. Proceed.
Thank you. We also have some modest administrative efficiencies system-wide. Between 2011 and 2012, we moved from overall administrative expenses in the system. This includes everything from president's office to business office to IT to HR, accounting, everything included, declining from about 12.4% in 2011 to 11.7% in 2012. On the next page, we're looking at the productivity, if you will, of our faculty. We've had substantially better management of the curriculum over the past decade. We have cut low enrollment programs. We're filling empty seats in classes before new sections are offered. We're focusing instructional resources on high-demand programs, and this has led to a substantial increase in faculty productivity. The chart shows the number of student credit hours per faculty member in the classroom. And what this shows is that over this time period, the productivity of the faculty is up 12.4%. We've also made a substantially better use of our facilities. The number of credit hours being generated per square foot within the system has grown 20% over the same time period. Again, back to Representative Winkler's questions, these are all measures of cost effectiveness of the operation. They do not speak to his question about the quality of the education. We can schedule a session on that. We'd be pleased to get into those details. The system office has declined in size and expenditures. As percent of
where exactly is this slide?
Six. Give me the tab so you have a copy.
Tab six?
Yes.
All right.
Tab six. First slide. First picture.
All right.
Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
As a percent of general fund expenditures, the system office has declined from 3.7% in 2002 to 2.2% in 2012. The budget of the system office is 24% smaller than it was 4 years ago. There are fewer administrators in the system office than a decade ago. There were 67 administrators in 2002. There are 62. In fact, there are fewer employees of all kinds in the system office, with the exception of information technology employees, which are largely MAPE employees, who've been at it to meet the exponential growth in technology needs. That's the place we need to have employees to respond to the new systems, the new technology, the growth in thousands of online courses and the like. And I'll give you a little more detail on that in just a moment. We did a study in 2008 that looked at the overall administrative costs of our system compared to the other systems around the nation. We ranked number 37 out of 50. That's one of the lists you want to be near the bottom, not near the top. Repeated that study in 2011. We ranked 40th out of 50 systems around the nation. Again, moving in the right direction.
I've got Representative Norton, I think, was on the list. I wasn't sure.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry I didn't yell fast enough, but I wanted to go back to the faculty productivity slide. Sorry about that. And I just had questions about how do you, I come from a K-12 background, and so I know we negotiate and we have limitations with which we have to work under in the K-12 system as to what you can expect of your faculty. And so I wondered, you have quite a great deal of fluctuation, and could you just explain to me how you're able to do that?
Chancellor.
Chair Pulaski, Representative Norton, a good question. There's really two big variables here that affect this. One is, if we continue small programs that are not serving many students and we have to deliver the whole curriculum to serve a small number of students, we have many classes with very few students in them. That's an inefficiency. So even if the contract says we can go up to X, we're way, way below X in those classes. So part of what we talked about last time was the net loss of almost 400 academic programs in a response to the cuts. And we made those cuts very strategically. Second, unlike a K-12 classroom where the class is set at the beginning of the year and other than students perhaps moving out of the district, the class is set, you're deploying a set of courses and then students have to decide where they're going to register for those courses. In some courses, let's say an introductory English class, you have to decide how many sections of introductory English you should make available. So if you make available 10 sections, but every one of those sections only has 80% of the seats filled, that's a much less efficient way to deliver the curriculum than if you put out only 8 sections and they're 100% filled up to the agreement we have with the faculty. So our colleges and universities have been very aggressive in trying to manage the curriculum in such a fashion that there aren't empty seats in classes, which produces a gain in efficiency with which we're able to deliver that curriculum.
Representative Norton.
So thank you for that, and I know you've been working hard at this, and I'm just trying to understand how
it says productivity is measured in terms of credit hours taught per faculty member. And so I'm wondering, how do you get faculty members to teach more, or is it measured per student in the classroom, and that's how the credit hours are counted? Is that what I'm understanding?
Chancellor, Chair Pawlowski, Representative Norton, exactly correct.
Thank you.
So it's not pushing faculty to offer more classes. They're already teaching a very heavy load, but rather making sure that the seats in their class are indeed filled.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor Rosenstone, looking at the declining administrative costs, I'm trying to put it in some kind of context as I review this information. In your opinion, is it a good thing or a bad thing? Should I be alarmed by the declining institutional support spending, or is this a plus? How should this be viewed in your perspective?
Chancellor Rosenstone.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Johnson, boy, you're really throwing me in the middle of it on that question. There are some places in the system office where we are very concerned, and our presidents are very concerned about our capacity to meet their needs. And I think probably our presidents would be better equipped to tell you exactly where they're concerned about whether these cuts have interfered with the ability to get the help they need from our office. As we'll see in a moment, 40% of all the employees in the system office are IT people. And we'll get into the details of why in just a moment. And our ability to continue to innovate in IT and provide the services for the backbone and the core learning programs that are deployed and used by teachers and in every one of our colleges and universities, our ability to continue to bring those to the place they need to be is in jeopardy if the resources are not there for those individuals. We have tried, at least during the 18 and a half months that I've been here, to try to target these cuts in a fashion that would protect the most critical functions for our colleges and universities. And the change in mentality that I have tried to put in place since I arrived is that everything we do in the system office has to be in service to our colleges and universities, and should not duplicate or be redundant with what is better done at our colleges and universities. So there are some places where we have made cuts where I don't think they've been a problem. There are other places where cuts have had to be made, which have really cut into the bone of what we need to be doing to serve our colleges and universities.
Representative Johnson.
That's enough for me, thanks.
Chancellor Rosenstone, it does sort of beg the question, maybe if you lowered more administrative salaries, you could hire more administrators then. Never mind. Representative Rosenthal. Nope, you're not on the list. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor, Representative Norton's question about faculty productivity and your answer to it I found interesting. In two regards. First of all, it seems to me, and I guess this is a decision made by local presidents, but a small program may have tremendous value for the few students who are in it, and it may be unusual, unique, but important in a small way, even though it doesn't look great on your chart. Likewise, if you offer sections of freshman English and they are not fully subscribed, but you have more choice in scheduling, it's obviously, I could well imagine it could be of great value to the students to have more sections available from which to choose, even if it doesn't look good on the faculty productivity chart. So, and I gather that the first part of your answer is going to be, well, the presidents make those decisions. But how are these kind of decisions made? What kind of evaluation is done to determine which small program should get cut because it's too small and not serving students well? And I mean, how do you sort of make those decisions? Or how do
Chancellor.
They?
Chancellor.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Winkler, these are among the most difficult decisions that are made on a college university campus, and you're quite right. There's a balancing act here between what are the available resources we have and how can we use those resources to both serve students as well as we can and also protect the diversity of times that students might want to take classes and the diversity of programs we have. If we went through the entire inventory of programs that exist on our colleges and universities, you will indeed still find some programs serving a few number of students where the decision was made, this is so crucial to the communities we're serving, the industry serving, that we will keep this program open even though it's serving very few students. That's the balancing act. What I can tell you is that in during the years that I made this, these kinds of decisions, as dean of a college, you were constantly confronting precisely the trade-off you were suggesting. Do we reduce the number of times that are available for students to take the class, but make sure the classes are filled, or do we do it less efficiently or more efficiently by not using resources and having, if you will, empty seats on every plane? It is a very hard decision, and it is a balancing act. But as resources got tighter and tighter and tighter, more hard work needed to be done to use those resources to serve more students with the resources that were had. And one consequent was reducing the number of sections, reducing the number of courses.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Chancellor Rosenstone, is the number of courses, sections, programs, et cetera, is that a function of the number of faculty? As we look at the employment growth in those previous charts, faculty was up 2.1% while enrollment was up 15%. I would imagine that the primary cost, and you can correct me, but when you're making a decision about cutting sections or trying to increase faculty productivity, if you're trying to keep a lid on the amount of faculty employment growth, those two things must be closely related.
Chancellor?
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Winkler, the number of faculty we have is driven by the number of students we need to serve, not the other way around. And so we don't have faculty and then go out and search for students, but rather we grow the faculty as student growth occurs, or if a particular program closes, the faculty associated with that program are no longer on payroll. And so it's a response to demand and response to the students we're serving that decides what the staffing levels need to be in any one of our colleges or universities.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Chancellor, we just got done with the conversation about closing programs, reducing the number of sections, et cetera. If those amount to savings, I assume that they amount to savings in faculty salaries primarily.
Chair Pawlowski,
Chancellor Rosen.
No, there's a ripple effect through the entire system in the following way. It also requires fewer people to process financial aid if there are fewer students. It requires fewer academic advisors if there's fewer students. We lose tuition revenue if there are fewer students. It ripples through everything. It's not just faculty.
Mr. Chair and Chancellor, I guess what I'm trying to get to is, in your employment numbers, academic professionals were up 21%, managers and supervisors were up 12%, administrators were up 5.6%, enrollment was up 15%, whereas services and support was down 3.4%, and faculty was only up 2.1%. So it looked to me like if you're looking at employees per student and you're trying to make decisions about closing programs, we are keeping a lid on the amount of faculty. We're doing less well at keeping a lid on the amount of academic professionals, managers, and administrators. So I guess my point is when these campus presidents are making tough decisions about closing programs or reducing the number of sections, the question I have is, are they making equally tough decisions about the number of non-faculty employees that they have? Because it doesn't seem like those were hit quite so hard.
Chancellor?
Representative Pawlowski, Representative Winkler, I can't answer for each of our presidents what their logic is and how they made these decisions. What I can do is go back to the data I shared just a moment ago, that when you look at the overhead costs, the administrative costs of this system in comparison to other systems around the nation, the most recent number we have from 2011 is that we're 40th on the list. That is, there are 39 systems of higher education in the nation that are running at higher administrative overhead than Minnesota State Colleges and Universities.
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, and that was actually, Chancellor, that was my other question. When your number of overall administrative spending per student, the list in which you rank 40th, what is included in the measure of administrative spending? Is that all of the academic professionals, managers, supervisors, and administrators? Is that just central office? What is that a measure of?
Mr. Schenecker?
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Winkler. Institutional support is a category that has been defined by the U.S. Education Department along with, you know, a broad range of categories of operational activity within colleges and universities. Institutional support would include functions like the leadership of the college or university, the president, the vice presidents. It would include the human resources function. It would include the business office. It would include the information technology that supports student records, employee records, institutional research function would be part of that institutional support category. Professionals that are providing student support services or doing academic advising would not be included in that expense category.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Shanaker. I'm just trying to understand the relationship between these things. You know, the faculty productivity, the ranking in administrative costs in combination with the employment percentage changes that you presented earlier. So it sounds like system-wide institutional support cannot easily be mapped into your employment changes.
Mr. Scheninger.
Chair Plosky, Representative Winkler, no, it would not be an alignment that would help you understand the trends in institutional support.
Thank you.
While we're on this, I had requested an explanation of why in the legislative auditor's report, when they evaluated MinSCU, they did a comparison of the administrators when you were three systems combined into one system, and the number was almost double. Now, you have spending. This doesn't tell me the number of administrators. You could have actually increased the number of administrators here, and your spending went down. But so how do you explain when the legislative auditor looks at you and says that when you were three separate systems, you had X number of administrators, and when you became one big system, and the goal was to make things more efficient, you have almost twice as many administrators?
Chair Pulaski, we've addressed that question in the very next slide, which looks at the total number of employees in the system office. At the time of the merger, the three systems came together with 333 employees. 2012, it was 313 employees. 60% of the system budget right now is IT. 40% of the employees in the system office are now IT. We don't have the exact breakdown for how many IT employees were there when the three systems were merged. As we'll discuss in just a moment, the exponential growth of IT needs in higher education explains the growth in the IT employees. So in terms of total number of employees in the system office, there's actually a decline of 20 employees, or a 6% decline since the merger of the three systems.
And how did the legislative auditor miss this? He's not known for missing much. And in fact, there's an article in today's paper. He apparently is looking at the nonprofits and some of their use of the grant money. So I'm hoping that his reputation is a reputation that, when we're done with this conversation, will be preserved. Mr. Shanaker.
Chair Pulaski, one of the differences between what has been reported earlier in the it was a report that was submitted by the Higher Ed Board just before merger about the numbers of employees, is they were reporting on employees that were in the community college system, the state university system, the technical college system. Primarily the state university system also had a substantial number of additional employees who were actually both housed at the campus and included in the campus counts of employees, but that did system information technology work. The state university system had regional computer centers at Mankato, at St. Cloud, had other IT staff that were at Minnesota State University Moorhead. The positions for those types of functions were not included in the system office numbers that had been reported earlier. Then in 2000, the auditor came back with legislative auditor came back with a number of 354 full-time equivalent positions in the system offices back in 1993 was their estimate at that time. So we took that number as the point of departure for this comparison of pre-merger and today in terms of numbers of employees in the system office.
So you're blaming the Higher Education Coordinating Board? Is that the group that fudged the numbers or didn't provide accurate numbers?
Chair Pawlowski, no, it was not the Higher Education Coordinating Board. It was the essentially the predecessor of our Board of Trustees, the Higher Ed Board. It was the that was the board that was created in 91 for the merger. They reported a number of 279 positions in the system offices, but then when the legislative auditor looked at it, they were able to identify those additional positions at the universities to get to that number of 354 positions. What we've done in the slide up here is there were a small number of externally funded positions that were included in those estimates. And so what we're reporting here is essentially base positions supported primarily by general fund dollars that would give you a consistent comparison between 1995 and 2012 in terms of number of system office employees.
And this includes the IT people?
Chair Pawlowski, yes, it does.
And can you tell me how many IT people approximately Minsky Central has hired?
We're going to move to that, Chair Pawlowski, right now. Roughly 40% of all the staff in the system office are IT related. And let me explain why, what they do, and how what they do is different than what happens at the campuses. So if we were to wind the clock back to 1990.
Well, wait a second. I've got another member who had a question where we were, and Representative Poppy has a question, and I interrupted the stream here, so Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's back to the faculty productivity. And maybe it's just I'm trying to wrap my head around that concept of faculty productivity as and how it's described here, but enrollment has grown 13% for the past 6 years, and faculty productivity is up. That seems to make sense, that the more students you have, the more you're going to be, faculty are going to be working with students. So my question, I think, a couple of questions. One is this done, though, at the expense of the students? Because as you talk about, I mean, if there's an increase in number of students and then you talked about the classes, course offerings, or being eliminated, or size of courses being increased. How has that impacted the students and their ability to get what they need to at the campus that they're planning to attend? Does that make any sense?
Chancellor?
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Poppy, it makes perfect sense. I'm kind of between a rock and a hard place here. If I were to come to you with data saying, you know, there's been no gain in productivity of our faculty over the last decade, and we've not had to cut any programs, and we haven't had to reduce any of the choice available to students, we're able to do all of that at the time of historic cuts to higher education, I can imagine how that conversation would go. Instead, we've been trying to balance precisely the kind of conundrum that you and other members of the committee have suggested are the tough questions. There will never be as much slack in the system or available options or any program you want could be found on any campus with this constraint and resources we have. The question you're asking, have we got the balance right? Have we cut places that maybe in a perfect world we wouldn't have? That's precisely the meat of the question. But as resources get scarcer and scarcer, those trade-offs get more and more painful to make. I'm impressed with the care with which our presidents and chief academic officers and deans have wrestled with this question. We talk about it a lot when the presidents get together monthly for our leadership council meetings. We, as I said last time, we continue to serve students that have entered a program until they've completed that program, so we're not putting students in the street. But there are many places around the state where you could get programs on a campus, and those programs are no longer available in the nearby campus. You may have to go now across the state to get that program. If this committee, if this legislature, if the people of Minnesota want many, many more options available to students so that English class is offered not 8 different times but 15 different times, if you want every single program to be available on every single campus across the state of Minnesota, it's going to take resources we simply do not have. And so I think it's right to ask, have you done the balancing right? Have you been thoughtful about it? But this is one of those consequences of declining state resources, is that the choices are not going to be the same choices they were a decade ago, whether it's choices of sections or academic programs and the like.
Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this raises another question about the increase in liberal arts courses and general education courses across the system. Career technical programs have declined, and the ability for a student to maybe become a welder or an electrician or a carpenter, a cosmetologist, whatever it might be, that would be career technical in nature, has decreased for students and made it more difficult for them to more locally get that education. But in the system, in the two-year system, the general education, liberal arts, English, history, math, science classes have increased. Is that, as part of that equation, is that a plus or a minus?
Chancellor.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Poppe, the problem there is not with our willingness or ability to offer the courses. The problem there is with whether there are students that will take the classes. And I'll give one example that concerns a conversation I had with President Johnson a year ago. I received a call from one of our U.S. senators saying we need more sheet metal workers in southeast Minnesota. So I call up President Johnson and say, is there a way in which we can work with this firm to get more sheet metal workers in southeast Minnesota? He said, I will put on a second shift and use our facility for a second shift to turn out 20 more a year. The problem is I have no students that want to take those courses. That's a problem we're going to want to return to when we talk about the next couple of years, because there's some new ways in which we need to be working with K-12 to build the pipeline of students into the professions that are in high demand in Minnesota. But it's not our unwillingness to increase seats for mechatronics, for manufacturing, for the health professions, for welding, you name it, for biotech. It is the supply of students wanting to take those courses. We have to respond to where the demand is from our students and try to work with business and industry to grow the demand in areas where there's critical needs for Minnesota. But under the financial model we're now handed, with two-thirds of all the costs being covered by the students and not the state of Minnesota, we don't have the luxury to open up classes that no one wants to take. It's financially not possible in the world we're currently living in. One could argue a decade ago, if state support was going to be there, regardless of whether students took the course, you could have lots of courses offered, and if they're only filled by 50% of the students, it didn't really matter because tuition was a third of the total cost. It's two-thirds of the cost now. Two-thirds are being covered by our students, almost two-thirds. So as we move to this different world of how we're financing higher education, it's going to produce different behavior to balance the books and hit this careful balance between what we need to be doing for Minnesota and what we can afford to do given the financial model we're living under. And that is a really tough and painful question. Mm-hmm. But I think we'll be talking about some solutions to do a better job as we get to the part of our conversations later this month about the next biennium.
Representative Pop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one other question on this slide. Would you be able to split it between the two-year colleges and the four-year? So we would see what the so-called productivity is in those two different systems.
Chancellor.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Poppe, Ms. Schoenecker says we'll be able to do that for you, so we'll work on producing that graph.
Chancellor, I want to go back on the declining administrative cost to that last statement. Overall administrative spending per student at MinSU ranks 37th out of 50 comparable state systems in the U.S. Do you consider that a positive statement?
Chair Pawlowski currently ranks 40th. It was 37th in 2008. It's 40th most recent data.
All right, so at 40th is a positive statement.
Chair Pawlowski, I don't know what the right number is, but, you know.
I'm trying to understand the meaning of this statement.
The meaning of the statement
I'm not
is,
sure I,
well, the,
because
the,
if I extrapolate
to me the meaning
it,
of the statement, to me the meaning of the statement is we are being very efficient in how we are delivering higher education in Minnesota State Colleges and Universities as measured by how much of it is overhead as opposed to the delivery of direct education to our students.
Then it would be a more positive statement to say you're 45th out of 50, or you would be 49th out of 50. That would be a more positive statement. Is that correct?
Chair Pawlowski, it depends on what you're losing to get to that.
Well, this isn't my booklet, it's yours, and you're using it, so I'm asking you how you're using it. Are you using it as a positive statement to say that your administrative costs are this efficient? Is that what I'm to get out of this?
Chair Pawlowski, yes and no. I'm using it to say our administrative costs are efficient, and that's a good thing, but that does not mean that continuing to cut that support will not have consequences, as we were discussing earlier, with respect to the IT support that our colleges and universities need. If further cuts lead to support of the resources that our faculty need on colleges and universities to serve students, that will be a problem for our students and for Minnesota.
Well, I'm trying to understand these statements, which taken at just black and white value, appear to be serving you, and then I would take it to the next level. Why aren't we 49th out of 50? Why aren't we the most efficient considering what's happened in this state? I ask it because if we're going to use national figures, where are we with the two-year intuition compared to where we were 10 years ago, ranked nationally?
Chair Pawlowski, we will get to the tuition dollar.
Well, I'm asking you now because if we went, and I'm told, from about the middle to second, we jumped an incredible amount in tuition over that time period, all borne by the student, and now we're going to translate it into debt. I'm wondering why we didn't jump in administrative leanness comparatively over the same, if this is a positive statement. And your explanation is an interesting one, that you have it in black and white, but when I ask if it's a positive statement, it's a positive and negative statement. So I guess you could use it either way. I used to coach debate a long time ago, and my students would love this.
Chair Pawlowski, I think we have a collective responsibility to use the people's resources as efficiently as we can, and I think what these data suggest is that Minnesota State Colleges and Universities has been doing that. We have additional steps we will be taking to further increase the efficiency with which you use those resources, and I think we have a responsibility to try to be as diligent as we can in doing so. During the time period that you just spoke about the rising tuition, let's recall the slide from last time. The state of Minnesota cut its support of higher education faster than almost every other state in the nation. That had consequences on our students, and we'll turn to those consequences in just a few moments. We also have one of the flushest state grant programs in the nation. So if you're just looking at the state-to-state comparison with respect to tuition, you're missing the fact that we provide more need-based aid to students in Minnesota than most states around the nation do. That would have to be factored into the comparison as well.
And when those cuts were occurring, there was not one statement from Minskew, from the campuses, or anywhere else about the long-term impact of those cuts and what they would do.
Sure,
in fact, your predecessor embraced them with a glee that to some of us was repugnant.
Chair Pawlowski, if you think or if other members of this committee think for one moment that I've been embracing the cuts that were made over the last decade.
No, I said your predecessor.
I understand that, sir, but I think it should distinguish me from my predecessor. I think I've been crystal clear with this committee about how deep those cuts have been, what the consequences have been, and as we'll continue the conversation today, the next section, I will show the consequences that they have had on our students. They have been extreme.
I wish the same consequences had been on the administration, but I'm not convinced of that yet. Representative Norton.
Well, just as I feel like I'm piling on, and I'm not meaning to, but as you were talking about, you know, your measurements and the high assistance we give, I think we also need to balance that with how high our tuition is compared to the rest of the country, too. And as I understand it, our tuition costs are quite high here in the state of Minnesota. Is that true, or am I misinformed?
Vice Chancellor, King.
The tuition costs of our universities are not out of sync with the rest of the nation, and certainly not out of sync with the alternatives within Minnesota. The tuition costs at our colleges is high for the nation as a whole, still the best bargain you can find in Minnesota for a two-year education.
Mr. Chair, the only thing I would add to that, just as a piece of history, is that it's at least important in the way I think about this, that the two-year tuition has been high for 20 years. It isn't something we didn't leap into this position in the last 5 years. It's a consequence of the funding relationship between the state and the student that goes back pre-merger. We haven't been able to improve that relationship. Right.
And that's exactly the point I was trying to get to. We have a wonderful system, and I know, and I think it's getting better, and I appreciate all the work that you're doing, but when we talk about what a great job we do with grants or scholarships or whatever, we have a historic philosophy in this state I fundamentally disagree with. And again, it's not your fault. It's been here. I don't support and I don't agree with, and I wish we could change this philosophy that we have of high tuition and then give high scholarship and grants, because I think it discourages students from seeing themselves at that next step, and I want to encourage students to be able to do it. And I also have serious concerns, and we'll talk about this as the year drags on for you, maybe. But the whole concept of the student loans and what it's doing to what I think is a setting a whole generation of students into a lower socioeconomic than they should status than they should have for the rest of their life. Because of what we're doing to them in the state, and I think perhaps even poverty for some kids who, certainly lower middle income for students who have college degrees, whether they be through the Minsker University system. So I just share that as, I appreciate that we give a lot to our students, but I think we have to do that because of the historic philosophy we've had, and it frustrates the heck out of me.
Chancellor, you told us at our last meeting that you were going to request that the trustees move to eliminate the bonuses that have been given to administrators, including your office. Can you testify that that request will be made and the trustees will act on it before the end of this legislative session?
Chair Pawlowski, I can testify that I will make that formal request to the trustees before the end of this legislative session. I cannot speak for the trustees about their action or the time of their action.
Well, I commend you for doing it. I would think it would go a long way if the trustees would take that action before the end of this legislative session, considering the scope of what it would take to raise in revenue to support your budget request. Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question about each of these different slides. Is there a goal in mind? Do you have a sense that the reduction in the size of the system office, for instance, have you met the right goal at this point? Are you still attempting to go lower? Are you attempting to add to the administrative efficiency, whatever those charts might be? At what point would you say, we've done enough? And this is, we need to stabilize now.
Chancellor.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Poppe, with respect to administrative efficiencies, I will argue that we will never be done. We will always be looking for new ways in which we can organize ourselves, purchase the things we're purchasing, do our business practices in ways that will make it more efficient so that more dollars are setting on the academic side of the house. In a few minutes, if we get there today, I will share with you what some of those initiatives are. And we have committed ourselves in the next biennium to producing $44 million in efficiencies that will be used to help cover the academic costs of the next biennium.
Representative Winkler, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure which of the testifiers should address this, but I'm stuck on something that we presented a long time ago, and I just can't get past it, which is the 21% increase in employment for academic professionals and a 12% increase in employment for managers and supervisors. And maybe you could just describe to me, do you have a different type of students? Are you providing additional services to students that are not in the classroom, as it were, than you used to, and why? I mean, I just see this 21% number is growing. The only one that grows faster than student enrollment is academic professionals. So what are we doing that we didn't used to do?
Chancellor or Mr. Schenecker?
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Winkler, one of the very significant initiatives within the system over the last probably 6 years, 8 years, has been what we've called our Access, Opportunity, and Success Initiative. And that was an initiative that directed dollars to the colleges and universities to improve the recruitment, retention, and success of underrepresented populations, students of color, low-income students, first-generation students. And so our colleges and universities have received additional allocations of state funds each year in order to expand services that will improve the retention and completion of those underrepresented populations. I'm sure that is that's a significant part of the growth in that area, and those are services that are outside of the classroom. They might be tutoring, creating learning communities, more intrusive advising of those students. There are a set of strategies that are proven with research to be effective at improving student retention and success. And so our colleges and universities have been expanding those services. The other large component of the growth in professional staff would be, as the Chancellor has referenced, in the area of information technology services.
Representative Winkler.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Shanaker, the Chancellor has talked about 40% of the central office employees being in IT. And these, I guess, this academic professionals, they would be spread out between the central office and all the campuses. Is that correct?
Shanaker.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Winkler, they would be primarily at the colleges and universities.
Representative Winkler.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Shanaker, I wonder, do you, I think you called it access, opportunities, and success. Is there data that you can show over that 6 to 8 time year timeline of success and results from that investment in those types of services?
Shanaker.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Winkler, we certainly can provide information on that.
Mr. Chair, I think that would be helpful.
Representative Winkler.
Because we're looking at, again, the only areas where we're significantly or even close to matching student enrollment growth is in these academic professionals and managers and supervisors. And so I would hope that we are getting bang for the buck in those investments. And I know we're going to, Chancellor has been eager to get to IT for a long time now, and I hope we're going to be able to see some benefits from a significant IT investments expansion as well.
Representative Pop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the Academic Opportunities Success Initiatives, how many of the presidents use that in their work plans, and how many of those work plans and presidents receive bonuses based on that initiative?
Mr. Shanaker or Chance?
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Poppy. As part of each president's performance review, and I can speak only for the one that I've completed and the one that's in progress and that I'll be completing this coming summer, presidents have goals they have to hit with respect to the diversity of their students and the success of their students. That is part of the president's evaluation each year and part of the determination of whether they are meeting the performance goals or not.
Representative Poppy, Senate.
Okay.
All right, proceed.
Technology. So let's turn the clock back to 1995 when the system was formed. The industry was still debating what the standard ought to be for the DVD. Larry Page and Sergey Brin were developing a search engine they called Backrub, later became Google. Mass use of the internet was just barely beginning, and the summer of 1995, Amazon.com sold its very first book online. Now, a lot's changed since then. There's a ubiquitous use of the internet to access information, data, and images from around the world. Online education has grown. The use of the internet for collaboration, social networks, and the use of the cloud didn't exist in 1995. Mobile computing, smartphones, tablets, all ways in which students interact with our systems, didn't exist in 95. They exist now. And the academic, financial, and HR and management systems necessary to serve students, manage our resources, do HR and the like, didn't exist. We have an IT platform that is an integrated student and financial record system. It supports 7 million unique person visits and processes 30 million financial transactions annually. It supports 2 million web page applications daily. At peaks, it handles 222,000 logins a day. Nationally, around the country, higher education institutions spend between 4 and 5% of their total revenue on enterprise IT. We're doing it in Minsky for 2.1% of total revenue being devoted to enterprise IT. There's a sharing of responsibility here, not a duplication of responsibility, but a sharing of responsibility. Our colleges and universities typically operate student computer labs, campus email systems, and support the instructional technologies like the folks who help faculty with online materials. They support desktop computing, the campus telephone system, and the help desk that exists on campus for their employees. At the system office, we support the single enterprise application for accounting, for payroll, for student records, and for the learning management system that's used on all the online or mixed mode courses that exist around the system. We provide the state backbone for IT that's used by students and faculty around the system, the network security. We have two data centers that provide 300 servers that are used by colleges and universities around the state. And if you talk with colleagues in the IT world from around the nation, what they're discovering is that they're now at the point where they have to make tens of millions of dollars of investment to replicate what we have been able to build gradually over time in the state of Minnesota. We are not resting on our laurels, but there are some next steps we're planning to take with respect to this efficiency question.
Chancellor, where were you exactly on that slide? Was it in this packet?
It is not, sir.
Okay, we've had a number of slides today that were not, and it is difficult looking at these screens. So I'm going to request again that before the committee, you give us whatever you're going to present so that we have it.
Chair, please, you'd be happy to.
All right.
But going back to something we
started. Stay there for a second. How many of your campuses are what you would consider a laptop campus or an iPad campus where the students either pay a fee or it's required that they have that technology in order to work at the campus level?
Chair Pawlowski, members of the committee, to my knowledge, there's only one which sets the standards for everybody else, and that is Winona State University.
And Chancellor, how long has Winona State had that program?
To the best of our recollection, it's 1998.
And Chancellor, that was driven at the campus level also. I believe that it has been somewhat controversial at the trustee level, to the point of even taking a vote that particular program stopped. So I'm interested that your explanation of how...
I believe you were mistaken, sir.
Well, Chancellor, it wasn't when you were chancellor, but...
But it was, Mr. Chair, it was when I was vice chancellor. The board has voted on this program on three occasions because it...
I didn't say they voted to stop it, but they voted on it, and the intent was to stop it.
We're required to bring to the board any contract over a certain number of dollars. The multiple-year contract for the Winona program requires Board of Trustees approval because that authority is not delegated to me or the president of Winona. The last contract, which was approved at the last meeting of the board unanimously, was a $3 million multiple-year contract to support the program. So it's not that the board disagrees with the program. It's the approval of a contract of that size which requires board oversight.
And I'm talking about previous votes that have been taken, and there were discussions that were of a different intent on voting on the contract. But I want to get back to your comments here. I support this, and I support what you're doing. But you just went through all of this and how important it was, and yet you only have one campus in the system that's driven by the technology at the student level. Why is that?
Chair Pawlowski, I beg to disagree with you.
Well, you just told me there was one. It was Winona State. Now, did I misinterpret that
answer? The only way
in
which technology is driven to the student level is not by having every student on the campus have an iPad. Technology is driven to the student level by literally over 100,000 students taking online courses right now. Being able to register online, find course materials online, and the like is the way in which technology is driven on every one of our campuses. You can't go to a single technical college in the system and not find technology driven into the classroom.
Chancellor, that wasn't my question. My question was what campus was requiring that the technology be given to the student, that the student have it and use it? And your answer was Winona State. I understand how you can take courses online. That's not my question. My question is, even now, you have one campus that makes that requirement. I realize the technology's there, but I think there has been a conflicted view at Minsky Central about how this is going to be used and when it's going to be used. And this was driven from the campus level, I know, because it took special legislation here to ensure that those students would be able to use their grant money as part of funding for the laptop, which may now be an iPad or something else. So I'm just intrigued by you have one campus that pushed the envelope, but you've got how many other campuses that are they also pushing the envelope?
Chair Pawlowski, I think we're just maybe perhaps just talking past each other on this one, so let me try to clarify. that a campus requires a particular device for all of its students versus one that does not mean that one that does not is not engaging students with technology. It's a different approach. We have it's just a different approach. The number of students that are interacting with these online systems using their phone or their iPad or their laptop is huge on all of our campuses. One campus decided to require it. It does not mean that the others do not have an integrated approach between the technology the students are carrying and the resources that are available for their education.
I don't disagree with that either, Chancellor. But we'll, okay, proceed. We've got about 10 minutes here.
Terrific. The next thing I want to go back to is something we began talking about a few moments ago, and that is this a continual process, or have we reached the point where we stop? And my response was, it is a continual process. We have embarked, starting in 2011, on a campus service cooperative. This, simply put, is a game changer in the way we do business within the system. We're looking at the area of procurement, HR, processing of student financial aid, and all business and finance operations across the system. It is a co-op in that we are moving off of the campuses and into a co-op around the state, the shared processing of these business operations. This is not, let me repeat, it is not a centralization of resources into the system office. None of this work will be done in the system office, but rather using the resources that exist on our campuses and the expertise to do things in a shared fashion that will save literally millions of dollars. So, for example, we're growing the amount of payroll processing that's done in Fergus Falls. Fergus Falls is moving up to close to a fifth of the payroll across the entire system. Why? Because that's the place within the state of Minnesota where the best team seems to be there and can do it most effectively for everybody else. Network access support, which is a way in which a student can take a course on any campus anywhere in the system and log on to the online resources available for that course anywhere in the system. That single sign-on is being housed at Winona State University because they have one of the best technology teams in the system and can do it for everyone else. This aggressive push on the campus service co-op will be part of how it is we're going to save $44 million over the next biennium to help hold down costs and cover some of the inflationary costs and compensation costs we need to cover. The other part of the cost reductions that will occur over the next biennium is the continuation of this process we talked about at our last meeting, to continue to look at academic programs, find ways where we can continue to consolidate or close programs to make the academic side of the house run more efficiently.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor, can you give us a sense of what share of the $44 million comes from the first bullet point and what comes from the second bullet point?
Chancellor?
Representative Winkler, I do not have the data in my head, but we can give you an estimate. In round numbers, within the campus service co-op, I believe we're looking at about $36 million of the $44 million, with the remainder coming from continuation of processes we've begun in the past.
Representative Winkler.
And Mr. Chair, Chancellor, so that leaves roughly $8 million in program review and closure, and I don't have the numbers in front of me. And I'm finding it a little bit hard to track back and forth between your slides, but that $8 million over that two-year budget cycle of worth of program review and closure, is that consistent with what you've done in prior two-year budget years, budget cycles?
Chancellor.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Winkler, it is probably lower than what we've done in the past because we've reached that critical point following our early conversation that given the huge number of closures that have occurred over the last several years, we're running out of room to continue doing that. There will be some of that will continue over time, but we cannot do that at the pace we've done at the previous 4 years.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chancellor. So I guess in order to deliver this $8 million in program review and closure savings, you're assuming, I'm imagining you're projecting a certain amount of state funding coming from the legislature for this is built into your budget, and you're balancing the program closure with tuition rates and with all the other initiatives that you have, including the access opportunity and success, IT, et cetera. I mean, this $8 million savings that you have on this slide is really just a result of your whole budget proposal, I would imagine.
Chancellor.
Representative Pawlowski, Representative Winkler. The proposal, which, again, we've been asked to hold back talking about until we get to that stage of the conversation, has a dollar-for-dollar match of resources that will either come from our efficiencies or dollars we will raise, going back to the earlier conversation of matches for grants for equipment and the like, to the request that we've made of the state of Minnesota. We felt it's critical that we bring some dollars to the table to help cover compensation costs and inflationary costs. The $44 million will be used to cover one-third of the compensation costs over the next biennium and all the inflationary costs of utilities and the like that will occur over the next biennium. They're not built into what it is we're asking the state of Minnesota to help with or our students to help with.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, Chancellor, I think in the future as we're looking at these cost reductions, I think it would always be helpful to have a to have this program review enclosure called out as a separate part of any cost reduction that you're proposing or as part of your budget, because I look at that as, you know, it's a combination of necessary trimming out of programs that are no longer relevant, as well as a potential reduction in service and to the students. So I just like to always know, you know, in my mind, you're looking at $36 million in efficiencies. In other words, cutting stuff out that doesn't really help anybody. But that last $8 million, it's a question mark about whether those are really serving students or not.
Chancellor, we've gone through a number of slides today that the committee was not in possession of before you did the presentation. We did have several meetings in my office, and we discussed what you were going to present. And I appreciate the time that's been put into this. We also requested in advance from Mr. Janicich the names of the individuals who would be testifying so we could put them on the agenda so that it would be public knowledge of who is testifying. So before the next meeting, can we have the material in advance? And in advance doesn't mean that Mr. Janicich or someone comes down here and starts throwing paper at us and we have to stick it in ourselves, but well in advance of the meeting so we can have it, take a look at it, and we know what you're going to do. It just would facilitate the process much better. I appreciate you reworking it. I like to rework a document myself. Notice even my little outline went to four drafts, so I know full and well that things change. And with that, Representative Durrell, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that the minutes of February 13th be approved.
Representative Durrell moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you very much, and I don't know who we're going to see on Wednesday, but we'll start where we stop. Thank you. Meeting is adjourned.